You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Today is Sunday, June 7th, 2026. Before we step into this hour, a brief reminder for our listeners. The reflections you hear today rise from the voices of our hosts and guests alone. They are shaped by their experiences, their convictions, and their search for truth. They do not represent the official views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. What you hear in this space is unfiltered. What you hear in this space is honest. What you hear in this space belongs to the people who speak it. And now, with that clarity set before us, we begin. This Week in Palestine is a space where truth does not tiptoe. It does not lower its voice. It does not wait for approval. Here, truth steps into the light with its full force, steady and unmistakable. Urgency is not an emotion in this place. It is the rhythm beneath every story. Clarity is not a luxury. It is the obligation we carry. And while our heart remains anchored in Palestine, in the West Bank, in Gaza, we also follow the currents that move across continents. Events unfolding far from the region still shape Palestinian life in ways that are rarely acknowledged, but deeply felt. Wherever you are listening from, behind the wheel on a long night drive, greeting the morning with your first sip of coffee, or sitting in the quiet of your home, thank you for choosing to join us. I am your host and narrator, Arlene Russell. In this space, we do not sand down the rough edges of reality. We do not soften the truth to make it more comfortable. We do not reshape the story to make it easier to hear. This is a place where truth stands unfiltered, where resistance is not a concept, but a daily existence. Where solidarity is not a phrase, but a legacy carried forward through generations. The voices rising from occupied land remain unwavering. They echo alongside movements around the world that demand dignity, justice, and liberation. They remind us that struggle is never isolated. It is intertwined. This hour is not simply a broadcast. It is a lifeline. A line stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, tying devastation to determination, tying sorrow to a future still worth fighting for. Even in the deepest darkness, the spark of defiance survives. Even when the world looks away, that spark refuses to fade. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, humanity, and unbroken resolve. We speak with intention because the stakes demand nothing less. This Week in Palestine is not a sanctuary for polite silence. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. The struggle for freedom is shared. It spans borders, and it remains sacred. We all heard about the call that shook the room, the call everyone is still talking about. Some say Trump was furious, so furious that even the walls could feel it. Others keep asking the same question. How did a conversation that private, that explosive, end up in the hands of the media? Was it leaked on purpose? Was it an accident? Was it a warning? Was it a message? We do not know yet. But we will. These things always surface eventually. What matters right now is simple. Whatever the intention behind the leak, whatever the motive, whatever the strategy, it worked. He screamed at him on the phone and said it without hesitation, without filters, without diplomacy. You have lost your mind, and you have forgotten every favor ever done for you. If it were not for me, you would be sitting in a prison cell right now, BB. I pulled you out of the fire. I protected you. And yet here we are, with the world turning against you, against your decisions, and against Israel because of you. That was only a fragment of the call, a sliver of a conversation that sounded less like two leaders coordinating policy and more like two men trapped in a collapsing partnership, each blaming the other for the flames rising around them. Then came the shouting. What are you doing? What in the name of hell are you doing? The kind of shout that carries frustration, fear, and the realization that the situation has spun far beyond anyone's control. Because the truth is, the ground beneath them is shifting. He told him plainly, the situation behind you is falling apart. Lebanon is on edge, its hand on the trigger. The region is not waiting for your next move. The region is preparing for its own. And that is the question echoing across capitals, across ministries, across the streets of the Middle East. Has the world finally begun taking its first real steps away from Israel? For decades, Israel operated with the assumption that global support was guaranteed, automatic, unconditional. But now? Now the tone is changing. Now the alliances are wobbling. Now the patience is thinning. Countries that once whispered their concerns are now speaking openly. Nations that once stood quietly in the background are now stepping forward. And the world, exhausted by endless conflict and endless excuses, is beginning to ask the questions it avoided for years. The phone call was not just a moment of anger. It was a symptom, a sign of a deeper fracture. A sign that even among allies, the trust is eroding, the confidence is fading, and the consequences are becoming impossible to ignore. Lebanon on alert, the region on edge, the world watching closely, and Israel, for the first time in a long time, feeling the weight of isolation pressing in. So, yes, maybe this is the beginning. Maybe this is the moment when the world starts stepping back, reassessing, recalibrating. Maybe this is the moment when the old rules no longer apply, when the old alliances no longer hold, when the old assumptions finally collapse under the pressure of reality. Because when a leader is told everyone hates you because of you, that is not politics. That is not strategy. That is a warning. A warning that the world is changing. A warning that the consequences have arrived. A warning that the era of unquestioned support may be coming to an end. And the question now is simple. Who will adapt? Who will resist? And who will be left behind? Now, all right, let us step away from the noise for a moment. Let us leave the leaked phone calls, the speculation, the who leaked it, and the why did it leak theories. Let us return to the real news, the news we follow every day, the news we investigate, verify, and bring to you with clarity. Because while the world was busy dissecting a phone call, something far more serious unfolded. Kuwait City found itself under fire. Not in flames, not reduced to rubble, but placed under a political and strategic spotlight that no one in the Gulf can ignore anymore. And the question everyone asked was simple. Who did it? The immediate answer was Iran. Of course, that is always the first name thrown into the ring. But then a second question rose, a quieter one, a more dangerous one. Or is someone trying to set the region ablaze for their own gain? Because what happened in Kuwait was not a random spark, it was a message. A reminder that the Gulf is no longer insulated from the wider regional war. A reminder that the fire in Lebanon, the fire in Gaza, the fire in Syria, all of it can spill over in a heartbeat. And then came the statements. Everyone pointed at Iran. And Iran said, yes,
We struck American military positions in retaliation for American attacks on our territory. They admitted that part openly. But then came the twist. Iran said, we did not bomb the airport in Kuwait. That was not us. And they pointed the finger back at Israel and the United States, accusing them of trying to widen the conflict, to drag the Gulf into a war it does not want.
Here is the strange part. The part that makes you pause. The part that makes you lean in a little closer. Neither Israel nor the United States denied Iran's claim. Not clearly. Not firmly. Not in the way you would expect if the accusation were outrageous. Instead, silence. A silence that invites questions. A silence that forces the region to think deeper. A silence that makes you wonder who benefits from chaos in the Gulf. And that is the game they want us to play. The deeper thinking game. The game of shadows, motives, and misdirection. Well, congratulations. It worked. We are thinking deeper. And I will tell you something. And this is my perspective, my reading of the moment. I believe Iran's version of events. Not because Iran is always honest, not because Iran is always transparent, but because the pattern, the timing, the silence from the other side, it all fits too neatly into a familiar script. A script where someone else lights the match and the region is expected to burn. This is This Week in Palestine. And here, we do not accept the first explanation handed to us. We follow the story until the truth shows its face.
So, all right. Since we opened the door to Kuwait and Iran, we cannot ignore the next chapter in this unfolding story. We have to talk about the Strait of Hormuz. Because if you want to understand the Middle East today, you must understand this. This is not the Middle East of yesterday. This is the Middle East of now. This is the new Middle East. For decades, the Strait of Hormuz was treated like an open water highway, a passageway for oil, gas, and the natural resources that keep the global economy breathing. A corridor shared by the Gulf states and Iran. A place where ships moved freely and the world barely paid attention. Then came the American mission to reopen the strait. A strait that was already open. Let me rephrase that. A strait that had never been closed in the first place. But we insisted on reopening it. A brilliant executive action for a problem that did not exist. And now we are living with the consequences.
Today, President Trump says the United States controls the Strait of Hormuz. Iran says the same thing. Both sides claim ownership of the same waterway. And as an American, I want to believe my president. I really do. But I also know when someone is not telling the truth. And let me say it clearly, he is not telling the truth. Look around the region. Every front is trembling. Every border is heating up. Every decision carries the weight of nations. Kuwait feels the pressure. Saudi Arabia feels the pressure. Qatar feels the pressure. Bahrain feels the pressure, though they like to imagine themselves as a regional superpower. The UAE is lost in the shuffle, still hoping Israel will protect them. Spoiler alert, it will not.
And then there is Oman. Quiet, steady Oman. A country where a single decision from its leadership can shake the global economy. They feel the pressure too. Iran, the self-declared Naqib, the chief, the tribal captain, is not feeling the pressure. Iran is controlling the pressure. And the United States? We are not controlling the Strait of Hormuz. We lost that influence the moment we lost the trust of the new Middle East. Israel believed it could ignite a regional war and walk away with control of the strait. They were wrong. They have always been wrong. Israel is drowning in Lebanon, and without American support, Israel would have collapsed long ago. So here we are, a single Naqib, one man, holding the power to choke the world's most important waterway. Again, let me repeat it. This is not the Middle East of yesterday. This is the Middle East of now. This is the new Middle East.
Now let us return to Kuwait. Kuwait City, a capital known for diplomacy, stability, and quiet Gulf politics, suddenly finds itself in the crosshairs of regional chaos. Not because Kuwait started a war. Not because Kuwait fired a missile. not because Kuwait provoked anyone. Kuwait is paying the price because the region around it is collapsing. And let me tell you something. If you have ever met someone from Kuwait, you know they are some of the most grounded, welcoming, respectful people you will ever encounter. They mind their own business. They treat others with dignity. They do not deserve this. And neither do the surrounding countries. Every nation in that region deserves respect. But here is what America did. We placed our troops in every one of these countries, promising protection from outside threats. We said, we are here to defend you. But the truth we do not like to say out loud, is that our military bases were never there to protect the Gulf. They were there to protect Israel. Only Israel.
Billions of dollars spent on protection, and when the fire came, none of that protection worked. So now, the Gulf states are preparing for the worst. Preparing for scenarios they never imagined. Preparing for a war they did not start. Kuwait is not a battlefield for Israel. Neither is Qatar. Neither is Oman. Neither is Bahrain. Neither is Saudi Arabia. None of the Gulf states are battlegrounds for Israel's conflicts. But the battlefield is moving closer. And the painful truth is this. It is moving closer because we helped put it there. Now, what about Lebanon? Because if you want to see where the real fire is burning, you look north. Lebanon is where the ground is shaking, where the sky is crowded with drones, and where Israel is sinking deeper into a conflict it cannot steer, cannot contain, and certainly cannot win on its own terms. Hezbollah's drones, missiles, and ground units have pushed Israel into a defensive crouch. Entire towns in the north are emptied out. Military bases are taking hits. Commanders are admitting, quietly, reluctantly, that they misread the northern front. The videos coming out describe Israel as gharik, drowning. Not poetically, not symbolically, strategically drowning. Every day brings new losses, new failures, new panic inside the Israeli establishment. The northern border is no longer a border. It is a trap.
And here's the part people forget. What happens in Lebanon never stays in Lebanon. The Gulf feels the tremor. Kuwait feels the tremor. Oil markets feel the tremor. Shipping routes feel the tremor. Because when Israel escalates, Iran answers. When Iran answers, the Gulf prepares. And when the Gulf prepares, the world economy starts sweating. This is why Kuwait is under fire. Not only from missiles, but from the shockwaves of a region spiraling out of control. So the North is burning. The Gulf is bracing. And all of it is happening because we helped create the conditions for this fire to spread. Trump thought he can control the Strait of Hormuz. Israel thought they can control the Strait of Hormuz. That narrow waterway through which one-third of the world's oil flows. The world's choke point. The world's pressure point. The world's global artery. Still under Iranian control. Still the most important waterway on Earth. As of now, as of tomorrow, as of a year ago. And guess what is coming next? Soon, every ship passing through that strait will be paying a fee to Iran and to Oman. Why? Because that is the power of geography. And the power of those who control it. And because we, in our infinite wisdom, marched into the region to reopen a strait that was never closed. Huh, bravo, truly. A masterclass in strategic genius. We should all thank President Trump for his remarkable ability to raise oil prices, trigger global panic, and shake the markets with a single sentence. Truly, history will remember this level of wisdom. Maybe the power of geography is stronger than the power of military. And maybe the power of those who control it is wiser than the power of beginning a war that we cannot exit from. And this, all of this, is the Middle East of now. Not the Middle East of yesterday. Not the Middle East of old alliances and old assumptions. This is the new Middle East. A region reshaping itself while the world watches. Okay, let's see. Back to Lebanon, the heart of the crisis. So Israel entered the northern front, believing it could intimidate Hezbollah.
instead, it found itself overwhelmed. Hezbollah's operations are precise, coordinated, technologically advanced, psychologically devastating. Israeli soldiers film themselves panicking. Commanders admit they miscalculated. Settlers flee the north. The army is stretched thin. Washington is trying to contain the crisis, but the U.S. is exhausted, distracted, losing influence. American officials warn Israel to de-escalate. Israel ignores them. The region watches. The collapse of American dominance is not theoretical. It is happening now, in real time, on the Northern Front. And Kuwait, like every Gulf state, is watching closely. So now, where does this go? Today, we look at a region wired with explosives, not the kind buried under soil, but the kind buried under politics, alliances, and collapsing economies. Lebanon is being booby-trapped, Iran is drawing red lines, and Israel's economy is sinking quietly beneath the surface. This is the Middle East of now, unstable, unpredictable, and shaped by forces moving in the shadows. If we look at Lebanon, Lebanon is not just a country. It is a battlefield waiting for a spark. The booby-trapping of the Lebanese arena as a deliberate strategy. Political paralysis, economic collapse, foreign interference, Israeli escalation, internal fragmentation. Lebanon is being prepared, not for peace, but for explosion. Every front is tense. Every faction is armed. Every border is trembling. Israel believed it could pressure Lebanon into silence. Instead, it triggered a front it cannot control. Hezbollah's operations are precise, coordinated, technologically advanced, strategically devastating. Israeli commanders admit the northern front is a nightmare. Settlers flee, bases are hit, the army is stretched thin. Lebanon is not collapsing. Israel is.
Behind the Lebanese front stands Iran, not as a puppet master, but as a regional power with a clear formula. If Israel escalates, Iran escalates. If Israel widens the war, Iran widens the map. This is Iran's deterrence equation. It is not rhetoric. It is policy. Iran signals through missile tests, naval movements, diplomatic warnings, coordination with allies. The message is simple. Lebanon will not fall alone. We all know Israel's military doctrine relies on overwhelming force. But overwhelming force means nothing when the other side is willing to absorb pain and respond. Iran's deterrence equation has prevented a full Israeli invasion of Lebanon, forced Israel to fight defensively, limited Israeli air operations, tied Israel's hands politically. This is why the Lebanese arena is booby-trapped. Any miscalculation triggers a regional war.
While the world watches the battlefield, something else is happening. Quietly, silently, dangerously. Israel's economy is collapsing. Not with dramatic headlines, not with sudden crashes, but with slow, steady erosion. Foreign investors pulling out, tech companies relocating, reserve soldiers leaving jobs, tourism disappearing, currency instability, rising debt, shrinking GDP. Israel's strength was always economic. That strength is fading. We all know war is expensive. Occupation is expensive. Mobilization is expensive. Israel is paying the price. Billions spent monthly on military operations. Thousands of businesses closing. A workforce drained by reserve duty. International boycotts growing. Credit agencies issuing warnings. This is the silent collapse. The kind that doesn't make noise until it's too late.
Okay, so look at this. Lebanon's instability, Iran's deterrence, Israel's economic collapse. These are not separate stories. They are one story, a story of a region shifting away from American dominance, away from Israeli military superiority, and toward a new balance of power,
a balance shaped by resistance movements, economic pressure, geopolitical realignment, the decline of old alliances. The Middle East is not waiting for Washington anymore. It is writing its own script. And this is how the serious show play. Lebanon is the fuse. Iran is the deterrent. Israel is the unstable actor. This is why the Lebanese arena is so dangerous. One miscalculation, one drone strike, one assassination, one border clash, and the entire region ignites. This is not speculation. This is the truth revealed inside a landscape shaped by decades of unresolved conflict. A truth that did not appear overnight. A truth that did not fall from the sky. But a truth built layer by layer through wars left unfinished, wounds left open, and questions the world refused to answer. It is the reality born from everything the region has endured and everything the world chose not to confront.
So here is the real picture. Lebanon remains fragile. Iran remains firm. Israel remains unstable. The U.S. remains distracted. The region is moving toward new alliances, new power centers, new economic realities, new military equations. The old order is collapsing. The new order is emerging. And Palestine, always at the center, feels every shift. Today, we saw a region wired with explosives. Lebanon on the edge. Iran drawing red lines. And Israel's economy collapsing quietly beneath the surface. This is not the Middle East of yesterday. This is the Middle East of now. A region where power is shifting.
A region where deterrence is real. A region where collapse can be silent. Until it isn't. I'm Arlene Russell. This is This Week in Palestine. And today, we watch the fuse burn. Don't go away. I have more for you.
Okay, enough with Iran and the Gulf region. Today, I want to talk about Mahmoud Talal al-Najjar. Mahmoud Talal al-Najjar is a Palestinian academic from Jabalia in northern Gaza, whose story drew international attention after he was detained by Israeli forces while attempting to leave Gaza to pursue higher education in Italy. According to multiple reports, al-Najjar had secured a scholarship and was expected at the University of Rome Tor Vergata, traveling with a group of 17 Palestinian students who had all received the required permits from both Israeli and Jordanian authorities. On June 4, 2026, al-Najjar was stopped by Israeli forces at the Kerem Shalom, Kerem Abu Salem crossing. Despite having all necessary authorizations, he was detained and transferred to an undisclosed location. His family received no official notification and learned of his arrest through social media and testimonies from others in the student group. Palestinian organizations described the detention as arbitrary and part of a pattern of enforced disappearances. The Israeli military publicly claimed, without providing supporting evidence, that al-Najjar was a Hamas operative involved in the October 7, 2023 attack. Palestinian organizations and academic sources strongly rejected these accusations, stating that he was an independent researcher with no political or military affiliation. Even Kogat, the Israeli body responsible for civilian coordination, was reportedly surprised by the arrest. Separate reporting revealed that Mahmoud al-Najjar is also the sole survivor of his immediate family, who were killed in an Israeli airstrike on October 25, 2024. The strike on their home in Jabalia killed his wife, Alaa Salem, and their four children, Rinat, Yazan, Mohammed, and Amr, as well as his brother, uncle, and multiple relatives. He had hoped to continue his medical studies abroad and eventually return to serve the people of Gaza. Before his arrest, al-Najjar had published academic research and worked for months to secure the permits needed to leave Gaza. His detention halted what was meant to be a rare opportunity for academic mobility, supported by Italian institutions and part of a broader effort to help Palestinian students continue their education despite the war. This is how the system works. This is how Israel, through its aggression and its unchecked power, tries to shape the future of every Palestinian life. Not through dialogue, not
through justice, but through force. The kind of force that decides who gets to live freely, who gets to be displaced, and who gets erased.
It is a system built on choosing who is allowed to exist. A system that behaves as if Palestinian futures are items on a shelf. Pick one, discard the rest. And when that fails, the alternative becomes even darker. Crush them, silence them, remove them, kill them all. Under occupation, no one is safe. Not the child walking to school, not the farmer tending his land, not the journalist holding a camera, not the family asleep in their home. Safety is not a right under occupation. It is a privilege granted or taken away at will. And this is the reality we speak about on This Week in Palestine, a reality shaped by decades of policies designed to control, fragment, and suffocate an entire people. A reality where the future is not something Palestinians are allowed to build, but something Israel attempts to dictate through walls, checkpoints, raids, and the constant threat of violence.
Yet even in this landscape, Palestinians continue to live, to resist, to dream, refusing to let their future be written by the very power trying to erase them. That is the truth we bring forward. That is the truth we refuse to soften. That is the truth the world must confront. A land taken, a freedom stolen, a people still standing. Our purpose here is simple and unshakable: to reclaim the story, to reclaim the truth, to reclaim what was taken. This is the voice of a people who refuse to disappear. This is the place where their story is carried forward. I'm Arlene Russell, and this is This Week in Palestine.
So now we arrive at our final chapter of the day. See, when someone is losing, they feel it long before anyone says it out loud. Some people try to correct their mistakes. Some try to rebuild what they broke. And some, the clever ones or the desperate ones, try to outmaneuver the collapse they know is coming. And that is exactly what Netanyahu is doing. He sees the ground shifting beneath him. He sees AIPAC's influence facing unprecedented scrutiny. He sees political winds in Washington changing direction. He sees the American public learning more, questioning more, accepting less. And he knows whatever happens in the next election cycle, whatever happens in Congress, the era of blank checks and unquestioned support is not guaranteed anymore. Not with the facts now visible. Not with the world watching. So what does he do? He reaches for the oldest trick in the book. Bind the United States and Israel so tightly together that separating them becomes impossible. And here is where the story turns. Some members of Congress are now pushing a proposal that would allow Israeli-made surveillance software to be integrated directly into U.S. military systems. Supporters call it cooperation with an ally. Critics call it something else entirely: a doorway for foreign intelligence access into American communications, troop movements, and classified networks. A doorway that, once opened, cannot be closed. The debate is fierce. The stakes are enormous. And the question hanging in the air is this: is Congress knowingly or blindly opening the U.S. military to foreign spyware? This is not a small policy disagreement. This is not a routine defense partnership. This is a structural shift, one that could reshape national security for decades. And Netanyahu knows exactly what he is doing. If he cannot guarantee political support, he will try to engineer structural dependence. If he cannot rely on public opinion, he will try to embed Israel into the machinery of American defense. Because once the systems are merged, once the software is integrated, once the intelligence pipelines are fused, the relationship becomes permanent, unquestionable, unbreakable. That is the strategy. That is the play. And now we turn to the debate that exposed it, a debate brought forward by Breaking Points. Let's listen together.
The Israeli government has been using antiquities laws for quite some time now to try to seize and annex West Bank territory and as well as Gaza territory at some point. But now the U.S. is getting involved in a more direct way. To help us kind of unpack what's going on here, Josh Paul from A New Policy is here to walk us through some of what he's discovered. And we'll also talk about this new development where the Israelis are responding to pressure on the U.S. to cut military support, or military spending to boost the Israelis by saying, well, how about we just integrate with the Pentagon? Make it all one thing. Yeah. So we'll talk about that on the back end of this, but on the front end of this. First of all, thank you for joining us, and congrats. I know you guys supported Adam Hamwi last night. Your colleague was up in Trenton, New Jersey.
Yeah, thank you. Adam is a great candidate. Actually, about 90% of the candidates we endorsed yesterday won their races or moved on to the next round. I think it's a sign that America is really shifting and the politics are finally beginning to catch up.
Right. People may remember Josh from a longtime State Department official who resigned in protest over the Israeli genocide in Gaza. So what is the American Heritage Commission? Like, tell us the story of this.
Sure.
This is a, and we can put this first element up on the screen. This is a crazy story.
It is an absolutely crazy story. And for us, it began by reading the Annual Appropriations Act that provides funding for U.S. foreign policy, which is moving through Congress right now. And buried deep in the text of this, you know, several hundred page bill is a line that endorses the work of the U.S. Commission for the Protection of Heritage of American Citizens Overseas or Abroad, and endorses in particular its work in East Jerusalem and its support to the Israeli City of David project. Mm-hmm. And that caught our eye because the Israeli City of David project is, as you said, ethnic cleansing under cover of archaeology. It's a project that has so far displaced over 1,500 actually Palestinians in the Silwan neighborhood of East Jerusalem, has demolished over 100 Palestinian homes in the name of an archaeological dig. And so we said, well, wait a second, what is this U.S. commission and what is its involvement here? So we did the research, and the U.S. Commission was created actually in 1985 in the Cold War. If you remember, this was the time of Pope John Paul II, the Catholic Pope from Poland, the time of Anatoly Sharansky, the Jewish dissident from Moscow. And so religion was front and center, and this commission was created, I think, as a part of that struggle with a particular focus on American heritage in Central and East Europe, in those parts that were then under Soviet influence. Today, the Heritage Commission, that remains its remit. That's supposed to be the left and right limits. And yet, starting a few years ago, it has been increasingly involved in backing Israel's ethnic cleansing and its archaeological, quote-unquote, digs, particularly in East Jerusalem. And if you look at the Heritage Commission, that's actually not that surprising because of who it is made up by. So right now, the chair of the commission is a lady called Leslie Weiss. She was the U.S. envoy to the International Holocaust Remembrance Assembly, the organization that came out with that now infamous definition that says criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism.
Which the U.S. then codified into law.
Which the U.S. And continues to try to advance and apply to shut down debate in academia. Yeah. Also on the commission's board is Herbert Block, who is president of the American Zionist Movement. And most interestingly, a New York investor, Joseph Dweck, who actually appeared on essentially a spin-off of a fake version of Shark Tank that was created specifically for Israeli settlers to pitch their ideas, for illegal Israeli settlers. So
that sounds like something someone would come up with on a fake Shark Tank, like SNL Shark Tank. Like, it's another version of Shark Tank, but it's for settlers.
And this is the guy who's now driving U.S. policy and now bringing Congress behind to support ethnic cleansing in the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Can you tell us a bit more? Go ahead.
Let's actually play a little bit of the Shark Tank first.
Yeah, let's roll this.
One of the main goals of the farm is protecting the lands of the State of Israel. By being here, that's actually what we're doing, giving Jewish presence to these lands that were deserted. Our farm project initiative comes to unite and bring together 42 farms of Judah and Samaria.
60,000 acres is the amount of land that our farmers protect in Judah and Samaria.
So tell us a bit about why they say what they're doing is important. So we've talked a bit about the outcome, but what do they say the stakes are for their ability to do what they want to do.
So, interestingly, if you look at the commission website, it actually doesn't make any mention of their work in Jerusalem or in Palestine, probably because it's well outside of their actual mandate. You know, they are given $770,000 in taxpayer money each year. This is a commission that meets twice a year. So how they're spending $770,000, I think, is a pretty opaque question and needs to be looked into. They refer on their website to their work in Europe. They make reference to one project they have in Armenia, but nothing on this. So I don't think that beyond they've done a couple of public statements and public engagements with an organization called Elad. This is another interesting thread to pull. This is an Israeli nonprofit that is backing these archaeological digs. It, in turn, is funded by a Russian oligarch, now sanctioned Russian oligarch, Roman Abramovich. So you have this US commission working with an organization backed by a sanctioned Russian oligarch to pursue ethnic cleansing in Jerusalem. The only, you know, real recent reference to that, beyond their public statements over, you know, 5 years ago, is now in this congressional text, in which Republicans in Congress are essentially backing the work of the commission in East Jerusalem specifically and trying to pursue funding for this City of David ethnic cleansing project.
And correct me if I'm wrong, the 2021 war in Gaza was sparked by this precise project.
Right.
The Sheikh Jarrah ethnic cleansing. Hamas said, stop, you know, evicting Palestinians from this neighborhood, or we're going to fire. They went forward and continued to ethnically cleanse the area. Hamas fired. Israel attacked Gaza back.
Yeah, and Jerusalem is a particular flashpoint. We've just seen in the last few weeks claims that some within the Israeli government are looking to shift what they call the status quo on the Haram al-Sharif or Temple Mount to, you know, expand Israel's presence. And, you know, that is such a tense area that drives, I think, a lot of instability, not only in Jerusalem and Gaza and Palestine, but across the Middle East. But it is also an agenda that fits very nicely into what some are pursuing through what they call Christian Zionism, which is, you know, essentially not only supporting Israel's objectives, but using this essentially as a means to lead to that ultimate battle that Christian Zionists believe will you know, bring back Jesus and, you know, lead to the end times. So I think it's a very dangerous project.
How does this antiquities law play out in the West Bank, and particularly the one that the Knesset is now pushing, one, an even more aggressive one?
Yeah, so in the West Bank, there are a number of sites where Israel is now trying to exert. So right now, Israel's occupation in the West Bank is by and large a military occupation. They are trying to create a new civilian archaeological authority to take control of certain West Bank sites that they call heritage sites. This would be essentially a de facto annexation. Right. Once you start saying this is no longer a military occupation, this is now under civilian governance, civilian rule, it's part of Israel. And so that's just another example of how Israel is trying to use archaeology as a pretext for ethnic cleansing and for annexation.
Well, what's interesting is what you said, that it seems like it's maybe a thin pretense here as well, and that if they're not even boasting about their archaeological progress or ambitions in this area, you mentioned they talk about Armenia and other places on their website, it seems like that's a rather thin pretext in this case if they don't have specifics they're pointing to.
Well, I think it's a thin pretext for the Heritage Commission because, again, this is way outside of their mandate. Israel has made a great show of its archaeological findings, although several of those have come into question in recent years. There was a famous case just in the last year where a coin that was found then later to be fraudulently created. So, you know, even to the extent, I mean, clearly there's a lot of important history in Israel, in Palestine, that deserves attention. But there's no reason that history can't be that of a shared history, a shared heritage, and understood, researched, developed in coordination, in cooperation with the Palestinians, rather than destroying their homes and displacing them from their historic land in order to promote a narrative, ultimately.
Mm. Let's put up B6. So people may have seen this this news that, you know, under pressure from J Street, AOC, like the increasing Democratic opposition to continuing to fund the Israeli military, which even Netanyahu has said, we want to phase it out.
Yeah.
Like we're done with this, these American subsidies. Section 224 of the NDAA Tell us what it's doing. Like, it's described as effectively blending together the Israeli military and the Pentagon in a way that would make it basically impossible for critics to come in and say, we want this stopped. How would this, as somebody from the State Department, whose job it was to oversee this relationship, or not oversee the relationship, but heavily involved in the relationship, what is the difference in this approach versus what we have had up until now?
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. So first, let's start by taking a step back and realizing, I think, one fact everyone, I think, at this point can acknowledge. AIPAC are losing. Mm-hmm. The American people have had a transformation of opinion, public opinion, when it comes to Palestine and to Israel. If we look at the current election cycle that you've been discussing, we see that there is very clearly an advance for those who stand up, who are willing to call a genocide a genocide. And in that context, what AIPAC are trying to do, and Israel and their allies, is essentially lock in the current relationship, mm-hmm. because they realize that, you know, these midterms might bring a shift in the House or in the Senate or in both, and it's just going to get continually harder and harder for them over time. Right now, we give Israel $3.8 billion of American taxpayer money every year for their military. In fact, in some years, significantly more than that. And that's just not going to be sustainable. I don't think anyone looking at current American politics, looking ahead, you know, 5-10 years, imagines that members of Congress are going to be okay with continuing that funding. So if you're them, what do you do? How do you lock in the current relationship and get around the democracy, right? Exactly. The public opinion and Congress's increasing unwillingness to just sort of hand out American funds. And the way you do that is by entrenching the U.S.-Israel defense relationship so deep in the machinery of the Pentagon and in the production of America's industrial base that it becomes impossible to root out. And that's what this section of law, Section 224, is trying to do. This is part of something called the National Defense Authorization Act. It's an annual so-called must-pass bill, mm-hmm. And it's going through the House Armed Services Committee tomorrow, Thursday, 4th of June. And this is in the base text. This has been put there by the chairman of the committee, Chairman Rogers. So it is going to be very hard to root out. I think we will have, you know, a shot tomorrow. Representative Ro Khanna is going to introduce mm-hmm. an amendment to try and strip it out. If that fails, Republican Representative Thomas Massie has said he's going to try to pull it out on the floor. And if that fails, then we still have a battle to fight in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And again, when the two bills come together during what they call conference in November, December. But look, this is in some ways the ballgame. Mm-hmm. Once this language is in there, it, first of all, tells DOD that it has to do everything it can to integrate Israeli technology into American weapons platforms. It identifies a series of areas for U.S. and Israel to cooperate and research together, including the most sensitive technologies you can imagine, biological technologies, quantum technologies, AI. And it creates an executive agent at the Pentagon whose job is to move this program forward. Mm-hmm. That's an executive agent who would be able to essentially overrule the people in charge of defense technology security at the Pentagon, the policy people, any of this. So once the ball starts rolling, it becomes very difficult to pull out. You see corporate contracts, government-to-government contracts, academic contracts being signed that are hard to unwind. And I think one of the worst aspects here, the final thing, is that it really flips the script on leverage. If you think about the U.S.-Israel relationship right now, we have the leverage. We don't use it.
Right.
We should.
But it exists.
But it exists. We can cut the funding. We can cut the weapons. Once you make American arms supply and the American warfighters' advantage dependent on the Israeli supply chain, they can do that. They can say, well, you know, we're not going to provide this technology anymore that enables your fighter jets, your electronic systems, whatever it might be. So it really puts us under their thumb.
And their specialty is cyber weapons and cyber surveillance. American or multinational tech companies have already absorbed enormous numbers of Israeli startups that are involved in the cyberspace. And so there's already a ton of that in there, but that's technically largely private companies, even though they're very much linked up with Unit 8200 and others, other elements of the national security apparatus. But so if they are in the factories and their specialization is cyber weapons and mm-hmm. cyber side, would that mean they basically have, or could have kill switches and tracking on basically our entire industrial base, and military industrial base?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's recognize why Israel's cybersecurity and cyber surveillance ecosystem is so capable. It's very much the same way that America's pharmaceutical industry became so capable in the 60s and 70s with, you know, experiments that they could conduct on unwitting populations in sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America. Today, Israel's cybersecurity industry can carry out experiments essentially on the unwitting Palestinian population. Right. And that's what they've done. And then they take that technology that they've developed on Palestinians and sell it to, for example, ICE to use on Americans. But it's very clear that that ecosystem cannot be trusted. There's, you know, been a number of lawsuits, public lawsuits. For example, Meta has sued an organization called NSO Group, an Israeli spyware manufacturer.
Which makes Pegasus.
Apple has sued them too. There's an ongoing suit.
Isn't Pegasus even banned by the US?
So, good question. Pegasus has been sanctioned by the US along with a number of other companies that specialize in cyber intrusions and, you know, revealing the information, and in part because Pegasus software was used to target American civilians and officials.
Jamal Khashoggi
and others.
So we're going to absorb a sanctioned entity and bring it into our own.
So first of all, there's warning signs that those sanctions may be going away. There is movement right now within the State Department to try and repeal those limitations around the NSO Group. But the NSO Group is just the tip of the iceberg. As you noted, all of these organizations have deep, deep ties, personnel, funding to Israel's Unit 8200, their equivalent of our National Security Agency. And, you know, Israel has shown no compunction whatsoever in its willingness to steal American technology, to steal American secrets, right? I mean, Jonathan Pollard, one of the most famous spies who stole American nuclear technology, is now in the Israeli Knesset. And this is the ecosystem that we're going to be bringing into our most sensitive military technology. It just is absolutely insane.
Desperation.
Yeah. So where are the leverage points? So you've got Khanna and Massey. For people who are watching this and aren't all the way black-pilled, because I can imagine a bunch of people just turn it off and like, all right, we're cooked.
Well, maybe the leverage points are that lobby from Apple and Meta.
Yeah. So the ones for people still watching who haven't completely given up hope. Who do people talk to?
So first of all, this isn't law yet. It's going through the committee, through the Armed Services Committee in the House tomorrow. But you know, you can call your representatives today and ask them whether they're on the committee or know people on the committee not to support this, to support Congressman Khanna's attempt to pull it out, to support Congressman Massey's attempt to pull it out on the floor if it comes to that. They should also be calling their senators to not put it into the Senate version of this bill. I think the more people are speaking about this, the more people are aware of it, they're feeling the pressure. So Mike Rogers...
I could see it becoming a litmus test vote.
I think it will be. And there's a lot of things that are going to be a part of this year's NDAA process. You know, the president is seeking an incredible increase in military funding. But I think this is going to be very much a test, including for Republicans, because the Republican base doesn't like this either. And I think they don't want to see their members voting to integrate our defense system, our most sensitive technologies, with a foreign country who can then use that as leverage. That's not America first.
Now, I'll say, Emily, you correct me if I'm wrong, because you know this Republican conference better. They believe right now, as long as they have Trump's endorsement, they're safe.
Yeah.
Trump will not be here forever. Not next cycle, but the one after.
He'll be here forever.
He might be here forever. He's the devil.
Yeah. Easy. He can last a long time.
He's in human form. He's immortal.
Yeah.
But let's say he isn't here forever. And let's say his influence over our political system fades. How dangerous do you think it could be to have this vote on your record in a Republican primary in a world in which there are open primaries because Trump is not able to just shut them off by endorsing people?
Well, and this isn't really even just a Trump issue. This is a broader America First issue.
Yeah.
And so I don't necessarily know that Trump is going to wade into primaries to defend people on a vote like this. But what I could see is people entering primaries because they now have this powerful tool to say, you voted for the most America last thing I could possibly think of.
To let a foreign government into our military.
Right. So that was just, I think that's just powerful on its own, not necessarily just in a sort of declining boomer power structure Republican Party that I think is powerful on its own. But it's the NDAA. That's the thing. That's why they're putting it in the NDAA, because it makes it impossible for many people to vote against.
Right.
That's why they're putting it there, because they can say, oh, you didn't vote for national defense. But that's what they're doing.
But there are plenty of opportunities along the way.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's certainly not impossible, although it's certainly going to be difficult, for a future Congress and a future administration to rescind this legislation. But the sooner, if this makes it into law, the sooner that's done, the better, because the longer it is there, the harder it will be.
Yeah,
right.
That's right.
Well, Josh Paul from A New Policy, thanks so much for keeping us updated. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Up next, election updates.
Before we close, I want to leave you with a reminder and an invitation. Jonathan Paz. If the name is new to you, it won't stay that way for long. We've talked about him before, and people across Massachusetts have been talking about him too. Not because of slogans, not because of spectacle, but because of the way he shows up. Supporters describe him as someone who doesn't talk down to people, someone who doesn't stand above the crowd, but right in it. Someone you can walk up to, shake hands with, and have a real conversation. Not a performance, not a photo op, a genuine exchange. And according to the people who back him, he listens, no matter your background, your faith, your income, or your story. There's something else his supporters highlight again and again. They say he is running without ties to organizations that could influence his positions. They describe him as independent, unaligned, and focused on the people he hopes to represent.
So if you've been hearing his name more and more, that's why. People want it to stay with you. Jonathan Paz, remember it. And now, the invitation. Come meet him in person at Ikigai Matcha Cafe in Framingham today from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., 33 Cochituate Road. You can also meet him today at Pavement Coffee House in Cambridge from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m., 1663 Massachusetts Avenue. Another meetup is tomorrow at the Fika Spot in Waltham from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., 619 Main Street. And another gathering this week at Bubble Nation in Arlington from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., 456 A Massachusetts Avenue. Come and meet him. Ask your questions. Share your concerns. Have a conversation. Or simply sit down with a cup of tea and see for yourself. I'll be there too at some of these locations. Let's stand together for what's right. Let's stand together for what we believe in. Let's stand together with Congressman candidate Jonathan Paz. And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. The slow dimming of a lantern. The quiet settling of truth after an hour that asked much of the heart. As you step back into your day, may you carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to fade, and the curiosity that keeps truth alive in a world that works tirelessly to silence it. I'm Arlene Russell, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor, an hour grounded in clarity, in dignity, in a solidarity that does not evaporate when the headlines shift or when the cameras turn away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or cracked open a door you didn't know existed, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is the quiet proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on every major platform: YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radio4all.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care, stay grounded, stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is occupied land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine from the river to the sea. Philistine Hora.